this show, there will be discussions of the true crime variety. Murder, mayhem, violence, and adult themes will be talked of. Listener discretion is advised. Hola, me llamo Grace. Welcome to Grace's World of True Crime Podcasts. What's with the Spanglish, Grace, you may ask? Well, I'm so glad you asked. I am going to be doing a deep dive today on the podcast I just binged out on. Its name is Selena, A Star Dies in Texas. It's a deep dive! So, on my deep dive of Selena, A Star Dies in Texas, this is from Vault Studios in collaboration with KIII-TV in Corpus Christi, KHOU in Houston, WFAA in Dallas, KENS5 in San Antonio, and Vault TV stations across Texas. They dropped their first episode May 6, 2020, and the last episode dropped June 2nd of 2020. I know Selena only by the movie starring J-Lo. So this was a great dive. I got to learn so much more about the crime that occurred that resulted in her death. So I'm going to start with the first episode is called La Flor. This episode covers Selena's early life, and she became a Tejano music superstar. She won the Latin Music Awards Tejano Best Female Singer 9 times before she was 18. That's 9 years in a row. So she had been working basically her whole childhood. Her father managed her career. She earned the name La Flor to represent her purity because she was such a sweet soul. And there's something I didn't know about her was that she was a Jehovah's Witness. And that whether that has anything to do with her upbringing, that does mean her father was very strict. You know, they were very religious, very modest. So it was very, I guess, scandalous that her outfits had, like, you know, such showed some skin. So Selena's father, Abraham, took his 3 kids on the road after their family lost their restaurant. She was kind and trusting when she hired a nurse to be president of her fan club and manage her boutique. This nurse was named Yolanda Saldivar. So the next episode is episode 2, happened on March. Oh, episode 2 is called March 31st, 1995. Yolanda and Selena go to a motel to talk about missing money from the fan club. When shots ring out and Selena runs to the lobby away from Yolanda and ultimately bleeds to death. The original standoff audio of Yolanda and the officers is played, and it's very devastating. She is saying she's going to kill herself. She's stuck in her truck, and this is just goes on for hours. The aftermath of Selena's murder shocks the Latin community and the world. Episode 3 is called State of Mind. As news of Selena's sudden death penetrates the hearts of her friends and family, experts try and understand why someone claiming to be best friends would kill them. How Yolanda's state of mind about being let go for theft and the accounting discrepancies was the trigger that made her go for the gun. That was absolutely true. Her relationship, a lot of people described it as she was very possessive of Selena and trying to monopolize all of Selena's time. And in this expert testimony, they say that a lot of times people who try and isolate you from your family and your friends, they absolutely have manipulative tendencies or are trying to get you to see their way and do things their way. I think that she was 100% being manipulative and was absolutely stealing from the company. Episode 4 is called The Trial of Yolanda Saldivar. So the trial's underway, and this legitimately happens just like a few weeks after the OJ trial was going on. So a complete media circus ensues. The prosecutor needs constant security because no one thinks that he's going to do the right thing. All the fans are just ravenous. They are out for blood. The trial's actually moved to another city because there are too many fans that want to be jurors, and they really are worried about security. The defense argues that Yolanda was going to shoot herself when the gun just went off by accident. But witnesses in the motel hear Yolanda run after Selena and yell, "Bitch," as she follows an injured Selena. So they really, she had the gun wrapped in a towel and was chasing after her. Selena ran for her life to the lobby and was able to call her out as her murderer before she fell over and ultimately died. So episode 5 is called Yolanda Behind Bars. Yolanda gets 5 to life in prison. I think that this is crazy. 5 years to life. That is a huge amount. That's a huge, I guess, despair. You can be there for your whole life or just 5 years. That's crazy to me. But anyway, Yolanda still insists it was an accident. Yolanda's sister, you know, ends up presenting a resignation letter that is dated a week before the murder. I think she said she was feeling threatened by Abraham, Selena's father. Prosecutors are looking into the legitimacy of the embezzlement claims by Selena's family. Yolanda does an interview and she never acknowledges the murder. Every time the reporter tries to ask her about what made you do it, what made you bring up the gun, she always says, well, we were, you know, dealing with this or this. And she makes up this story that Selena is wants to run away with a plastic surgeon doctor that she fell in love with in Mexico. And I 100% believe that Yolanda is just as manipulative and as star crazy and hungry as possible. Episode 6 is called Gone But Not Forgotten. Regardless of Yolanda's obvious manipulative delusions, Selena still has a ravenous fan base. She came at a time in America where the Latino community desperately needed representation in media and role modeled who came from humble beginnings into international stardom. Today, Selena fans pick up where their parents left off. She legitimizes the experience of being a Mexican descendant with Spanish-speaking relatives while speaking mainly English and identifying as Texan-American. With today's tense stance on immigration and hate crimes against the Latin community, learning about the life of Selena has been an absolute blast from the past, and she represents so much beauty and purity of heart. She is gone, but is truly never forgotten. I absolutely thought this is a great little insight into Selena and her life and the crime that occurred between her and Yolanda. So I always thought this was kind of like just a crazy fan ended up shooting her and killing her like out of nowhere, but they in fact had a very close relationship and one that I believe was very unhealthy with Yolanda really trying to look for attention in any way that she could, and especially with what happened leading up to the murder. It's a great listen. It's beautiful and it made me fall in love with Selena all over again. I've been absolutely obsessed and I'm going to go ahead and watch the movie with J-Lo again because that was J-Lo's big breakout role. That was absolutely it. She was just perfect for her. Anyway, that's my deep dive on Selena. A Star Dies in Texas from Vault Studios. This segment we like to call Weeklies. For all those weekly cases, you know. This week on Serial Killers, we cover the starvation doctor, Linda Hazard. So Linda Hazard was a charlatan and a con who practiced with no medical degree at any formal college. She practiced as a fasting specialist in the 1900s, so during this time, she didn't go to college or school or actually know how to do anything medical. She was a nurse, you know, for some things, but in this time, you could just practice your medical license wherever, whenever. This was a time in American history where there were no regulations on health and human safety, so many people had no actual medical knowledge, were just running around and claiming their snake oil can cure anything from STDs to paralysis. But Linda's particular brand of snake oil was convincing people that fasting was a miracle cure. The fact that it killed her paying customers wasn't a deterrence. It was the intended result, as she then robbed them and moved to the next desperate patient. And if things ever got too hot, she would just move. So this case should be a huge reminder in this day and age that medical regulations and concerns for the health and well-being of human lives are there to save people from opportunistic quacks. The second part of her story shows the, you know, her... how her downfall. It happened with Claire and Dora. They were these two heiresses from England, and they really bought into her alternative medicine. So they were actually on fast for almost 2 months. We're talking only eating a cup of tomato broth and like a tablespoon of orange juice. These people were, they were starved to death until Clara died. But Clara was able to send a message to her governess in Australia. So by the time her governess got this very weak, short message, she knew she had to save them. It was too late for Clara, but she was able to get Dora out. She was very weak, and Dora suffered immensely from that amount of starvation for that long. She suffered lifelong health problems, but she was able to get her attorneys to view over all her paperwork and found that not only did she sign a new will while with Linda Hazard, she also signed over her, she also became her power of attorney. So she had to switch everything over legally before she can then pursue a trial for the death of her sister. She only got a slap on the wrist of 2 years and was able to practice as a fasting specialist again at her sanitarium, which was no more than a couple of log cabins. And they were just brutal. They would have to make her patients have daily enemas for hours, and massages that were literally just getting punched. Ugh. So anyway, alternative medicine at the turn of the century was batshit freaking crazy, and people like Linda Hazard took advantage of it. She did die as almost poetic justice when she fell ill and decided to treat herself with her fasting cure, and ended up starving to death. So if there's any justice in the world, perhaps it's that her own delusions killed her. This week on Cult Leader, we do the case of Betty Broderick. So Betty was raised as a good Catholic girl and married her husband Dan and had 4 kids. Her husband went to school and she supported them and their growing family until he became a hotshot lawyer. But this hotshot lawyer husband started banging his assistant, and what ensued was a brutal divorce. Betty straight up was losing it. She was calling, leaving threatening messages on the phone all the time at all hours of the night. She even drove the car into the front of the house. All this was just the worst, nastiest divorce you can think of, until one day she wakes up. At like 5 a.m, she grabs her gun, goes into the house, and shoots both Linda, his assistant, and her husband, and then was arrested for it, obviously. But this was just a crazy story, and you're just like, wow, Betty, chill out. But I'm like, wow, Betty just lost it, man. But anyway, that is the story of Betty Broderick. If you've never heard of that, that is on Cult Leader. That was a really great tale. I love it. This week on Generation Y, they covered the murder of Jennifer Evans. So Jennifer Evans, she was a good Baptist girl from Atlanta, and she was just on vacation with her friends when she meets 2 Navy SEALs in training at a bar in Virginia Beach. Their names are Dustin Turner and Billy Brown. Jennifer and Dustin are hitting it off, and Dustin's friend Billy Brown is being an obnoxious, roided out drunk. But this is nothing new for him. Apparently, he goes through this all the time. But when Jennifer goes missing, Dustin leads police to her body 8 days later. Billy blames Dustin. Dustin blames Billy. Both are in jail. The end. The point of this is very interesting in that we don't know what happened. We are only going off the testimony of Dustin or Billy. And I think that's where the trial goes off, because Billy ends up actually going to prison shorter than Dustin. And it's argued that Dustin didn't even kill her. It was Billy, 100%. He just helped him, his friend, Billy, get rid of the body. So that's the moral question is, you know, if you were there at the site of a murder, should you still be held accountable for that murder? To be honest, they're both in jail. The end. I'm done with the analyzation. But if you want to go ahead and look that up, that is on Generation Y. They did the murder of Jennifer Evans. This week on the Murder Squad, it was a big week. We got the Humboldt Five, Part 1 and 2. And in between that, they did the their final sort of analysis with their buddy Paul Haynes on the Golden State Killer and that trial that just occurred. They had an extremely busy week, and ultimately that gave me a very busy week. So Billy and Paul are investigating the disappearance of five young women from Humboldt County, California. This is known as the Emerald Triangle, as this is a huge marijuana farming operation. And when these ladies disappeared, marijuana was not legal. So a lot of these growers were taking very territorial of their space and often putting up traps, like very dangerous gun traps, and people would end up wandering off and you could end up dead if you ended up tripping over the wrong trap. So the names of these women is Jennifer Wilmer, Karen Mitchell, Christine Walters, and Sheila Franks. A few of these women were, two of them, I believe, were found, their skeleton remains. The rest are completely gone. So that's what the Murder Squad is trying to do, is find out if anyone in this Emerald Triangle, Humboldt County, California area know anything about the disappearance of these women. Please put in a tip and let's help solve some murders. In between all those was their very interesting Golden State Killer analysis. They looked over more evidence. They were able to talk about the case. They were able to talk about the impact statements, the Joseph D'Angelo, the Golden State Killer, had to say for himself. And it was very cathartic. And oh my gosh, these guys were really busy and they had me busy. So check those guys out. Murder Squad. They got a lot of episodes they put out this week. It was busy for me. On this week on the Crime Countdown with Ash and Elena, they did Haunted Murder Sites. This is a Parcast original, and it's a great little listicle on haunted murder sites. It's the Lizzie Borden House, the Tower of London, the Colosseum of Rome, all have a crap ton of murders, and subsequently a crap ton of ghosts. Check out Crime Countdown if you're into that spooky stuff. And also, there was another podcast on the Morbid Network, is That Spooky. Now, they did Tyler did a case on the Dulchmer pig, which is a demonic pig in Dublin, which was pretty interesting, and it is a spooky old tale. But the thing that really piqued my interest was about the Wacker family from Massillon, Ohio, in Stark County. This involved William Lewis Wacker, and Dorothy Jean Wacker. They're both old people. William was born in 1920, and Dorothy was born in 1927. They married in 1940. But in 1984, after all the kids have moved out, and they should just be little old people living their life, their house was ransacked. Nothing was taken. Then it was ransacked again. They decided no police were called. These people are like from Depression era. They don't mess around. They take care of house. They apparently didn't want to get the police involved. But then Dorothy is attacked by a young man asking to use her phone. He hits her on the head and ties her up. She wakes up and gets the neighbors, and police are finally involved. This goes on for 8 years. We're talking poundings on the house in the middle of the night, rocks and bricks being thrown, threatening, scary phone calls. 8 years. And then one day they decide to put their story out on Unsolved Mysteries, because this was just constant barrage of harassment, and they were scared that they would come back and possibly assault Dorothy again, which actually happened when she was outside and gardening, and somebody struck her from behind in the head and just left her there when she woke up. Like, who does this? It's crazy. They put out the Unsolved Mysteries episode, and then like a switch, it stopped. Never happened again. They were able to live in peace until their death as just regular old people, but they never found out who was harassing them all this time. That was crazy. Never heard of it, but that's spooky. And that was a lot of fun. Tyler and Johnny telling us some crazy stories. This week on my absolute favorites, we have a lot. So October is the busiest time of year for many of these podcasts. It's spooky season and they are pumping out the material because everyone loves Halloween and we're kind of getting screwed over on it. So F you, Corona. Let's get onto the podcast, you wonderful sons of bitches. So Morbid is Murder of Marlene Warren. Marlene answered a knock at the door on May 26, 1990 at her South Florida home and was greeted by a clown holding flowers and balloons. She took the flowers and balloons and was promptly shot. She was 40 years old. Marlene's husband's mistress, Sheila Keene, is currently on trial for allegedly pulling the trigger. Orange wig fibers were found on the getaway vehicle and her apartment. Corona is postponing her trial. This was a crazy, clowns. No one likes them. And if they're murderous, that's even worse. Thank you so much, Morbid, for spooking me the F out. Morbid also put out an ad-free kind of a listener tale. It's so good. An actual writer did it. What's his name? Bill Allen, I think. I forgot his name. Jesus Christ. But it's a fantastic story about how this young boy was raised by a very dysfunctional mother. And what happens is he ends up finding out that there's like a ghost in this house that he doesn't want to be at, that she's partying in. And this ghost seems to be taking care of them. Oh, his name is John Allen. John Allen edition. And that is his story. It's really cool. Really good. They also came out with another one because they are just pumping them out and I can't even keep track. I'm doing my damnedest. This weekend wine and crime, we got a Gossip at the Corpse Cart. So Gossip at the Corpse Cart was made after a joke on the show and it involves Amanda reading the funniest, weirdest, and wildest headlines. Kenyon asks listeners, what's the worst thing you've ever done? On Coven Confessions. And Lucy gets to be as gross as she wants on Coroner Coroner. It's a fabulous time. Check out Wine and Crime. This week on True Crime Obsessed, it was Death at the Mansion Part 2. So this is this is Rebecca Zahau murder / suicide. So Patrick and Jillian go back to the Oxygen Channel's investigation of Rebecca Zahau. Although Billy Elizabeth Jensen and Paul Blazer Holes and the rest of the forensic experts agree Rebecca couldn't have killed herself, police believe they got it right and they don't seem too interested in bringing Rebecca's millionaire boyfriend to justice. So there you have it. Another millionaire asshole gets off scot-free. Thank God for our justice system, right? No. This week on Obsessed with Disappeared, it is covering the disappearance of the Jamison family. So Sherilyn, Bobby, and their 6-year-old daughter disappeared October 8th, 2009. Their truck is found by hunters with their dog, who, by the way, survived 8 days in the truck. So the dog's fine. $32,000 were in a bank bag, and there was no sign of struggle. WTF, you may ask, but after doing some Google research, they did find 3 skeletonized bodies in the woods 3 miles away from the truck. What happened? We have no idea. No clue. It's just a goddamn mystery. That is it for this week. I'm so glad that you guys listened to me. Check me out on Instagram if you so wish. I am Grace True Crime. You can check me out on Facebook. I'm at Grace True Crime. And on the Twitter, at G True Crime. Or just look up Grace's World of True Crime Podcast. You can find me on Spotify, Google Podcasts, and a bunch of other ones. Or Anchor. Just check me out on Anchor, guys. That's also how you can do it. If you go to the Anchor app, then you can find my little link where you can drop a little support line if you like. You know, otherwise, I'm out. I enjoyed it. I can't wait for next week. Talk to you later. Bye. Yeah, I just felt like playing you guys out with a little something. Nice, you know? Good luck, everybody. Don't be an irony. We love you. Bye. Next time. Goodbye. See ya.